Okay, so now we're here after the break, right? So I'm looking at a slide. The insula is right there. All right, the insula is involved in bodily self-awareness. It's very activated in meditation. It didn't happen to be very activated in the preceding slide of boundless compassion, probably because the person doing it was just, you know, very out there with a very subtle mental state that required, though, a fair amount of focused attention. Whereas these nuns, and probably no accident, they're female, are very in their body with this kind of luscious, really rich sense of joining with Christ. Additionally, they lit up one of the major reward centers of the brain, the caudate nucleus. The caudate nucleus is part of the basal ganglia. It's one of those really important subcortical structures that's involved in bottom-up motivation and intention, we talked about earlier. And it lights up, for example, if people win the lottery or get a sudden windfall, good event. I'm not equating this profound and deeply important kind of prayer with winning the lottery, but it's interesting that the same neural circuits, at least at a gross macro level of resolution, enabled these by current technology, that the same neural structures are activating related to the reward, the fulfillment, the very physical, luscious, delicious fulfillment of this prayerful activity. And that for me is an illustration of where the meeting of the brain and the mind adds value. I think a lot of the times when we read about the brain and the mind these days, which is a very sexy, you know, big topic, it's old wine in new bottles. And the pitfall there, of course, is just glamorizing it as one more way to, you know, sell books and pack a haul. So I try to avoid that pitfall to the best I can and keep looking for where is information added, where is practical utility gained. And this for me is an example of the way in which understanding what's happening in the brain as we compare these two practices help gives us insight about what might well be happening inside the mind and what the distinctions might be between, let's say, a boundless compassion practice and a Christian absorption and love for Christ kind of practice. Okay? Which is a way for me of illustrating this broader point, you know, that let's go after what actually adds, in, you know, value. All right. This is a slide of enduring changes in the brain. The slides we previously saw, the previous two, were temporary changes in terms of regions that are activated because that's the mental activity that's being used or deployed in that moment. This is a slide from a pretty important study. By the way, at the very back of your slide set, I've listed a number of really good books, if you're looking for an introduction into this area, that are accessible and the real deal. They're very solid, as well as, you know, kind of a 30 greatest hits papers. And this is one of the greatest hits, Rick's greatest hits. They're not my hits, right? I just think they're great. From Sarah Lazar. This basically is a study that showed long-term changes in the brains of long-term practitioners who did contemplative practice. And three regions in particular were physically thicker. The amount of thickening was about 200th of an inch. That doesn't seem like much, probably, but it's enough that matters probably, you know, another million new synapses in that region. One is the insula, tracking the internal state of the body. These are the executive portions of the prefrontal cortex involved with top-down executive control of attention, very linked to the anterior cingulate region. And then a little sensory motor strip up here where the people were noticing, you know, their own bodies, okay? Other examples of how mental activity can change neural structure are found in London taxicab drivers. As you may know, this example is fairly well known. At the end of their training, where they have to memorize all the twisty, spaghetti, gnarl, you know, streets, spaghetti tangled streets of London, their hippocampus, part of the brain involved in visual spatial memory, is measurably thicker than it was at the beginning of their training. Okay, and it wasn't that they had thicker hippocampi, because there are two of them, than other people, it's that their hippocampus or hippocampi were thicker at the end of their training. Okay? So again, mental activity changes neural structure. You know, neurons that fire together wire together for better or worse. Another really interesting finding is, as I mentioned earlier, we lose brain cells as we age, and one of the results of that is called cognitive or cortical thinning, the bark, the cortex, the gray matter skin, if you will, on the outside of the brain, with all these little folds and so forth, gets progressively thinner. That's a normal process. So compared to controls, let's stand over here, the controls are the blue dots. Oh, beg your pardon. The controls are the red squares. And as you can see, as people age, in terms of, this was, I believe, this was not a longitudinal study. These were different cohorts, or, you know, this was cross-sectional, in other words. The bottom line is that the older people who do not have any kind of a meditative practice, and this was a sort of a vague Buddhist practice, right? Kind of Vipassana, kind of mindfulness, whatever, you know, in terms of subject recruitment. The bottom line is they, the ones who did not have a contemplative practice, had thinner brains in these regions of interest, in these three areas. Whereas the meditators, the ones who routinely used it, maintained the blue dots. They maintained neural thickness. That has a lot of implications for an aging population. You know, I got some gray hair, I see some gray hair in the room. Use it or lose it. You know? Use it or lose it. That's the takeaway point here. Okay. There are some interesting related findings that contemplative practice does seem to buffer against cognitive decline. There are some anecdotal reports of meditators who've been autopsied after they died, in which and their brains had a significant number of Alzheimer's plaques, yet they didn't seem to have any loss of function. There's also been one study, the only study I'm aware of religious practice, at least in America, and linking that to cognitive decline due to aging or the progression of Alzheimer's. And there was about a 15% reduction in symptoms due to religious life, very broadly defined, an N of about 85, only one Buddhist in the population, mostly probably Christians in America. That 15% reduction in symptoms due to religious life is equivalent to the best medication result available today in terms of psychotropic meds for early Alzheimer's. So this kind of scales it all for. I think there are a lot of pathways whereby religious life, you know, buffers against cognitive decline, including downregulating stress, because stress is like a corrosive acid on the brain. I think what I better do is keep going with some of these points and then take questions kind of en masse a little bit later, if that's all right. Okay, so here's a slide that lists some of the physical effects of meditation. I find that one of the, I wrote an article recently called "The Brain So What?" And I think there's a lot of hoo-ha about the brain, and I'm in that world and I see a lot of hoo-ha. That said, I think there are at least four good benefits for brain stuff. Why don't I list those right now as sort of an overarching structure. Learning about the brain, I think, has practical value for people in the helping professions, let's say mental health. One, because it gives us an overarching structure for kind of looking at different theories and practices in sort of a universal and, in a sense, kind of neutral way. Like, in other words, what effect does MBSR have on the brain compared to dialectical and behavior therapy, or dialectical behavior therapy, compared to psychoanalysis, compared to, you know, cognitive behavioral training and so forth. That gives us a way to think about the effects of all these different things in terms of a common target, neural outcomes. Second benefit is that it promotes conviction or motivation. It's interesting that one of the seven factors of awakening, or one of the factors of awakening, is motivation or conviction. I find myself, when I talk about the physical results of meditation or the physical results of wholesome mental activity, particularly with teenagers and particularly with men, a lot of generalizations around that, that they find this much more persuasive. So I find that this kind of stuff is pretty cool because it enhances motivation, okay, when we can talk about something physical. The third benefit of learning about the brain from a practical standpoint is that it helps us really appreciate what really works best out of the 10,000 tools in the therapist's warehouse, right? Very often what happens is when you learn about the brain, you find yourself emphasizing a particular approach, like somatic learning, right? Or the importance of bringing in the nonverbal, or the importance of holding painful experiences within a very nurturing and loving frame. But, you know, and then people go, whoa, this is really important. Those methods have been around forever, right? Wilhelm Reich was talking about embodied learning. Jung talked about intuition and, you know, visualization. Carl Rogers was talking about, and Maslow were talking about positive psychology long before Seligman, you know, went to graduate school. But now it's like the T.S. Eliot poem, you know, at the end of our journeys, we're where we started, but now we know the place for the first time. So that's the third kind of benefit. And then the fourth benefit is the really cool one. It's when learning something about the brain actually allows you to innovate in terms of mental practices for the mind. And I'll offer what are, for me, a couple of potential innovations. I've never heard of them before, and they are suggested by learning things about the way the brain works. So those are the kind of four things. And listing the physical benefits of meditation relates to one of those four benefits, which is, you know, motivation or conviction. All right? So you can see some of these benefits here. I don't need to talk too much about them. I think they're pretty clear. The one I want to just mention in passing about the power and reach of gamma range brainwaves, basically when neural circuits, you know, fire together, they fire rhythmically, and their firing involves an electrochemical process. So each firing gives off a little spike of electrical activity, and when a neuron stops firing, there's a drop in electrical activity. Well, that spike and drop creates a wave, you know, a peak and a trough. And when you have neurons forming a coherence with each other, so they're firing rhythmically, like, you know, clapping in unison together, that produces measurable brain waves in terms of electrodes, like in, with an EEG on the scalp. So the point is that brain waves are an epiphenomenon of mental activity. Maybe in some broad way, waves, you know, connect the brain to each other, but most of the brain connects through neurons connecting with each other, and brain waves are simply an indicator. It's like an instrument panel on the dashboard of a car. It's an instrument indicator of what's happening. Well, the key point here about gamma range waves is they're very fast. And fast waves, 30 to 80 times a second, when they're firing together, they're really promoting synaptic formation, because neurons that fire together wire together. And they have to fire together, by the way, within a few milliseconds. Within a few thousandths of a second, they have to be simultaneously firing to get the formation of synaptic structure. So if you have very fast waves, you force a lot of accuracy and synchrony in the firing together, and therefore you promote building neural structure. So gamma wave activity promotes learning. It promotes psychological growth and healing, so we care about it. And one of the things that long-term contemplative training does is that it increases gamma wave activity. All right, that's maybe more than you really wanted to know, but there you go. All right, moving on. Let's see here. Let's see. So this is a fundamental takeaway, you know, from this stuff on meditation. And then to keep going, given that we can use the mind to change the brain to change the mind, mind broadly defined, you know, which really means change the being and every other being whose life we touch. To do that, though, we've got to get on our own side. And a lot of people in my personal experience aren't really for themselves. They don't have a particularly strong attitude of being on their own side. So as a foundation practice, I think that getting on one's own side is critically important when one is working with people in the world, and it's critically important for ourselves. For example, as I was speaking to the gentleman's question about the difficulty in activating positive emotions and how to deal with that, and one of the very first places to start is through intention. In other words, by getting on one's own side, that one's own happiness matters. What's in the inner temple matters. Is it a bouquet of flowers or the product of canine metabolism, right? What's the result here? It's only when we care about ourselves that we care about what's inside the mind. So I find it helps people to actually think through what could be some rationales for getting on their own side, and I've listed some of them here. It's really interesting to think about that it's a general principle in, you know, morality, that the people we have the greatest power over, we have the highest duty toward. Well, who's the one person in the world that we each have the greatest power over? It's our future self, right? that's the person that we have the greatest duty toward. And to me, that's the person that we have also the greatest opportunity to affect, you know, the outcome of that person's life. I love this little poem here. It's a lyric from a Leonard Cohen song. Sometimes we think to be on our own side, we have to be perfect. I love his opening line. You know, ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. Right? He's a very serious Zen practitioner, Cohen is. He's been practicing and studying for a very long time. If you have an opportunity, if you like his music a lot or just are curious, there's a great documentary about him. I think it's called He's the Man, which is a line from one of his songs. And it has him, it has his Zen teacher down in Southern California in America, as well as him talking about his life story, as well as people performing his music in Canada, which is really quite marvelous. Anyway, it's a really good thing. So we don't have to be perfect. We don't have to be perfect to be on our own side. We just have to ring the bells that still can ring. And as he says beautifully, it's the cracks inside us. It's our imperfections that allow the light to come through. So this gets here at the idea I said earlier about transcending mental contents, also as a way to relate to being on one's own side, as a kind of foundation for what we're about to go into, which is the negativity bias in evolution and why taking in the good matters. At the end of the day, sometimes I think it's great to appreciate that ordinary awareness, the ordinary basis of mind, has a fundamental wisdom to it. We evolved to have as our resting state, when we're not threatened, when we're not in pain, when we're not upset, when we're not hungry and so forth, our resting state is characterized by what I call the three C's: calm, contented, and caring. And that's our resting state. And one might add to it conscious and creative. All right? Those are really the five C's: conscious, calm, contented, caring, and creative. That's what we are. That's what people fundamentally are, deep down inside. And to have some faith in that and to be able to increasingly access those home bases, if you will, as a kind of refuge, being able to find our way back there again, is a great asset when one goes out into the world, period, and definitely they're a great asset when one engages any kind of personal practice or healing of distress and dysfunction. And it's also really useful for other people as well. So on that basis, now let's talk about the bad news, all right? Evolution. It's pretty great, I think, or it's useful just to get a sense of the scale. I mean, in a sense, a lot of what today is about is playing with scale, both in terms of time, in terms of long time, like 3.5 billion years of life on this planet, as well as scale in terms of neural assemblies forming within a tenth of a second and dispersing within a second or two, right? So you get a sense of that kind of scale. It's also great to get a sense of scale in terms of spatial dimensions, in terms of the planet as a whole, let's say, or the universe altogether, as well as a sense of spatial scale down at the level of neurons and synapses. For example, in the width of a human hair, you could put about 5 neuronal cell bodies side by side in the width of a hair. You could put about 5,000 synapses side by side in the width of a human hair. So that's, again, an appreciation of scale. All right, so evolution, right? 3.5 billion years altogether of life, about 650 million years of multi-celled creatures. The nervous system developed because these early multi-celled animals had to connect their sensory apparatus with their motor apparatus so they could move toward the pleasant or move away from the unpleasant. 600 million years later, you know, crawling up on the land, early mammals, early primates, early stone tool using relatives, you know, 100,000, 150,000 years of, you know, basically what are called modern humans, very close genetic copies of us. It's been a long, long run, hasn't it? It's kind of wild to imagine that our stone tool using ancestors lived about 100,000 generations ago. In terms of biological evolution, each generation is a reset. It's an opportunity for reproductive advantage, which is the engine of biological evolution, to take hold and make a difference over time. There have been 100,000 resets, you know, since our earliest stone tool using relatives. They had brains a third the size of our own. The brain has tripled in size in the last 2.5-3 million years. Most of those functionalities, interestingly, have to do with social skills. They have to do with cooperative planning, language, empathy, self. Isn't it quite remarkable? And as I'll talk more later, there's what's called the social brain hypothesis, that it's actually really been love, more than war, broadly defined, that's driven the evolution of the brain. I'll actually talk about that kind of quickly here, because it's pretty cool, right? I mean, you probably know this. For a long time in the history of psychology and philosophy, there's been this debate about whether humans are fundamentally good or bad, right? Or neutral, or how do we think about that? Or are we fundamentally hateful or fundamentally loving? How do you think about that? Did the brain evolve based on tool users who use tools for violence and, you know, aggression and exploitation and taking what other people had? Or did we evolve primarily based on cooperative engagement with other beings in our band? Well, the evidence increasingly is that the right answer is the latter answer. In other words, the brain evolved basically in three major steps. The first step is in vertebrate evolution. For example, if you think about fish and reptiles compared to birds and mammals, birds and mammals have a bigger brain per body weight than fish and reptiles have. What do birds and mammals do? They both deal with tough environments. They both deal with, you know, lethal predators, crazy things, stuff happens, etc. But what do birds and mammals do that fish and reptiles don't do? They care for their young. Tim had the right answer. All right. They care for their young, and they also pair bond, sometimes for life, in part to care for their young. That's what they do. In the phrase of the neuroscientist, the computational requirements of choosing a good mate, someone you can kind of deal with after the kids come along. Oh my God, my first book was about taking care of mothers over the long haul and also relationships after kids come along. You know, my wife and I were doing great until our kids came along, right? And then you have to work stuff out. How do you handle teamwork? How do you stay in love? How do you even stay friends? Oh my God, the whole thing. You need a bigger brain. So those sparrows and those squirrels have bigger brains than iguanas and sharks because they got to think about more stuff. Isn't that cool? You know, love, ba-boom, right there, the first major step in the build-out of the brain. The next step came in with primates. Primates are the most, you know, social family, if you will, of creatures on the planet. Yes, there are herd animals like cattle, but they're not very social with each other. They kind of move around and they do a certain amount of interacting, but not like a baboon troop, right, or a chimpanzee troop. And interestingly, the more social the primate species, in other words, the more grooming partners a typical member has, the people they scratch and so forth, or the larger the band typically, or the more complex the dominance hierarchies, or the more complex the alliances, the bigger the primate brain relative to body weight. Because again, the more alliances, the more who's in, the more who's out, it's like watching Survivor. You know, these TV shows, these reality shows, or Big Brother, whatever, they put people in a house and let them go to war. It's like Lord of the Flies inside some mansion in Beverly Hills, okay? You gotta have a bigger brain to do all that stuff in some kind of primate troop, right? So that, again, just one, I'll keep going here, drove a major jump in terms of the size of the brain. And then, I should say in passing, I love this little study. They did a study on grooming behavior in macaque monkeys. And what they did is they, first of all, noticed that they spend about a sixth of their day, probably 2 to 3 of their waking hours, about a sixth of their waking hours, grooming each other. Now, a little bit, that's a protein source. Good bug, right? All right, it's a bit of a protein source, but there's not much protein benefit there. Then what they did, scientists, they shot these monkeys with a dart gun, put them to sleep, did a blood draw. and then looked at cortisol and other stress hormone markers, you know, in terms of macaque monkeys, to see who is getting the greatest stress relief. In other words, who is feeling more relaxation and happiness and joy, the one who is grooming or the groomee, the giver or the receiver? The answer is counterintuitive. The one who gave, the groomer, had the greatest stress relief benefit. Isn't that interesting? Now, I've tried to use that argument with my wife. Shot down in flames. But anyway, isn't that kind of cool, right? We get the stress benefit by being generous, by taking care of others, by scratching their back. All right. The third big jump was in human evolution. 2.5 million years, brain tripled in size. A lot of hot research about how evolution occurred, not so much at the level of the, or in addition to occurring at the level of the individual, it occurred at the level of the band, which mainly bred with each other. So for example, in the Serengeti in Africa, in these very harsh and lethal environments, where at different times in evolution, for example, like around 1.8 million years ago, I just read a recent study, which is halfway, ballpark, between a third of the way at least, from stone tool using relatives and us today, there were only about 18,000 early hominids alive on the planet. Think about that, 18,000. If those 18,000, that's what we consider these days an endangered species, 18,000 members right there. At another time, about 70,000 years ago, which includes modern humans, apparently some giant volcano in Indonesia blew up, and the total population of humans on the planet shrank because there was like a nuclear winter, if you will, for several years, which killed a lot of plant life and made survival really tough. The human population, the human breeding stock narrowed to around 15,000 people. There have been a lot of, you know, twists and turns along the way. Anyway, along that run of bands competing intensively with each other, and as I was just saying, very harsh environments, the bands that could cooperate with each other did better compared to bands that could not. And it's interesting, when you have 100,000 resets, 100,000 opportunities for genetic evolution to occur, very small differences add up within 1,000 generations. For example, if let's say you call the one band is the cooperative band and another band is the not so cooperative band, right, or type, and let's say the cooperative band has a 1% improved chance of survival. But if you accumulate cooperative bands compared to not so cooperative bands, and you start out, let's say, with 1,000 of each there in Africa, over 1,000 generations or so, ballpark, this is ballpark, the bands that have that 1% survival advantage will fill out and dominate all the niches in that ecosystem, because that 1% makes a big difference over, you know, 100,000 generations. So during that long run, as I said, bands that could altruistically cooperate with us and, alas, be very effectively aggressive against them did better, and we have inherited their genes today. So I think that's still pretty neat to think about, that how love, broadly defined, has actually driven the evolution of our brain in those three major steps. All right. So quick one question maybe, and then I'll roll on. Yeah. Yeah. What she's pointing out is a recent observation that if you look at humans' faces compared to other primate faces, you can really see the whites of the eye, which enable us to really track expression. Because if you can't see the whites of the eye, it's really hard to read expressions in the eyes, at least. Also, the face is very expressive emotionally in many other ways as well, which is an illustration, as you're bringing up, right, of how deeply, deeply social humans are. So, 2% difference, ballpark, between chimpanzee DNA. Chimps and bonobos are our nearest relatives. We are actually as genetically close to bonobos, which is another species in the great among the great apes. We are great apes sitting in this room. Woo-hoo! So here we are together. Chimps are very cranky, aggressive, violent, and nasty. Bonobos, though, if you know much about them, are wonderful. They really believe in making love, not war, literally. All right. What's the point of all this evolution? It's grandchildren. I think it's really interesting to think about that the unit of transfer where reproductive advantage matters is the grandchild in evolutionary terms, in biological evolutionary terms, because the human lifespan is long enough that if grandparents promote the survival of their grandchildren in harsh environments in the wild. And, okay, so it's grandkids, that's the whole point. We evolved in kind of what's called the triune brain, sort of three stages. It's almost a little bit like an ice cream cone. You know, you got the first, you know, scoop, the second scoop, and the third scoop. The first scoop is sort of the inner, I think of it as frankly the inner spider and lizard, because we have bug brains inside our head. It's kind of remarkable to realize that some of the motor neuron nuclei in the brain stem that control speech are exactly the same, essentially, as those in fish. Fish vocalize. A lot of fish make sounds, even though we separated from the fish 200 plus million years ago. But those circuits and the genes that code for those circuits have been conserved within our brain today. One thing that is also a takeaway for me from this brain stuff is a deep felt sense of kinship with other living creatures. You know, we are carrying their DNA around with us. You know, we carry plant DNA around with us. Our DNA is about 25% identical to the DNA in a banana. That kind of puts stuff in perspective. We take ourselves too seriously sometimes. You know, think about, you know, the inner banana made me do it. That's the banana made me do it, honey. But anyway, so. Anyway, so then we have paleomammalian, that's sort of the early mammals, you know, reaching in even to some primates. And then we have the modern neomammalian and primate brain. It's easy to take the triune brain too seriously and kind of, you know, use it as a cop-out. Oh, my lizard brain made me hit you. No, I'm sorry, you're still responsible for that. But on the other hand, it does help us understand that, for example, responses that originate lower and lower down in this whole thing is called the neuroaxis, from bottom to top and top down. It's an axis, neuroaxis. As you go down the neuroaxis, responses become increasingly rapid and increasingly automatic, and less and less amenable to reflection and judgment. As you move up the floors, or up the scoops of the ice cream cone, up the neuroaxis, responses slow down, they become more flexible, and they become more amenable to reflection and intervention. And there's been a kind of tension in evolution, and this is a lot of how evolution occurs. It tries to balance competing needs. There's been a tension between the need for responses in terms of survival, because that's the bottom line, right, and passing on genes. There's been a balance between the need for fast responses and flexible responses. Fast automatic responses have a kind of rigidity to them, but slow, diffuse responses, while being very flexible and judicious, may come too slowly to protect your baby from the leopard that's attacking. So that's kind of a tension there. And a lot of what we do, I think, as therapists, is we often, particularly when we're dealing with emotional reactivity, trauma, and all the rest of that, we're trying to help, you know, connect the cortical paleomammalian, or neomammalian, rather, circuits that are slow but very powerful and very reflective and judicious and flexible. We're trying to drill connections down and connect some wiring down in the lower centers that are very quick, automatic, and intense. Right? Okay. So three stages of evolution. That kind of recaps what I've said so far. And I want to do this slide. This is a good basic slide. It's from our book. Sorry that it's cropped in this weird way. It's a kind of PowerPoint artifact, at least at my skill level. But you can see basically the key regions of the brain in terms of social emotional activity. We have the prefrontal cortex up going this way in the upper left area there, which is very involved in judgment, reason, planning, reflection, insight, the executive functions, and all the rest of that. And then we have the subcortical regions that are much more involved in emotional activity as well as in reward and motivational activity. And then we have the brainstem itself. Okay, so let's quick pause here. Any questions so far about evolution in the brain? And then I'm going to go into the negativity bias. Yes, please. And thank you for being patient. Yes. So if I got the question right, it was whether there is a general loss of nerve cells throughout the brain as a whole, and also is there, in terms of the gray matter, the cortex, the bark, which is a lot of where the action is that we care about, whether there is a uniform loss. I do not know the exact answer to that question, and I'm going to find out because it's a great question, isn't it? What I've in all my, you know, imperfect but fairly wide-ranging, you know, sieving of brain science stuff, I've never seen anyone describe any differential, any lack of uniformity. I you know, if you think about it, it would be astonishing if it were uniform. So I suspect there's some differential. What is clear, though, in the slide that I showed you previously, is that in these three regions of interest, two in particular that we care about, one, the insula, which is involved with interoception, gut feelings, you know, being in touch with oneself, being in one's own body, mindfulness of the body, that's all the insula. The insula is also critically involved in empathy. Talking about reading facial expressions, there are three fundamental circuits of empathy in the brain. I'll do this part really fast because it's not this workshop, you know, but one is about where we essentially simulate actions. That's where mirror neurons or mirror-like circuits come in. We also simulate emotions. That's the insula. The insula registers and actually resonates with emotions in other people. For example, to oversimplify, if I'm having the emotion of sadness or anger or joy, let's say, you know, 100,000 neurons are lighting up in my insula. If I see you having the same experience, anger, sadness, joy, with nuances involved, maybe 1,000 or 10,000 of the same neurons light up inside my insula that light up when I'm having that emotion. Thereby, I'm getting a sense from the inside out of what it's like to walk in your shoes. So the insula is a really important part of the brain. And then, of course, also the executive systems of the brain and the prefrontal cortex that are involved in controlling attention, as well as a lot of other things. Definitely, normal cortical thinning in those regions is neutralized through sustained contemplative practice, which is pretty far out. The thing I should really stress is that science these days is at the beginning of really understanding the brain. I think a good analogy is that neuroscience today is, and neuropsychology broadly, is roughly where biology was about 100 years after the invention of the microscope, which is to say around 1725, right? It's just beginning. And another very cool thing, and then I'll do a couple more questions, is that we are participants in that inquiry right now. To do this work, in other words, to try to figure out what in the world is going on upstairs, we're like the early naturalists who just walk around and count things and measure things and turn stones over and go, never saw a bug like that before, let's write it down. I just discovered a new kind of bug. You don't need a million-dollar cyclotron, or these days, billion-dollar cyclotron, or an MRI to do this kind of work of stitching together plausible connections between the mind and the brain, you know, particularly from a pragmatic standpoint. We're participants. We're collaborating in that great endeavor these days, which I think is just fantastic. Okay, a couple more, then I'm going to move on. How about you and then you? You. The therapist might benefit from what? Oh, I see what you're saying. Very good. Maybe the therapist needs to have a banana at lunch too, you know, get a 2-for-1. Yeah, no, I think that's totally true. Totally true. Physician, heal thyself. Thank you. All right, one more, then I'll keep going. Yep. Yeah, sure. So, let's see. What was mirror neurons are neurons that, for example, let's do it like this. So, how about everybody reach for an imaginary cup? All right? Fine. So, to do that, in round numbers, let's say, about 100,000 neurons lit up in certain sensory motor regions of your brain, particularly at what's called the temporal parietal junction, like right around here. Okay? Now, watch me reach for a cup. Guarantee you, some fraction, 5%, 10% of those neurons that lit up inside your head when you reached for a cup, lit up when you watched me reach for a cup. Especially if you saw me reach for a real cup. Then it would really go to work. Those are called mirror neurons. Technically, no mirror neurons have really yet been discovered in the human brain, partly because we can't do the invasive procedures to find them. But it's widely accepted that there are mirror-like circuits in the brain that, in effect, simulate over here the sensory motor activities of you over there, which is a very efficient way to read the physical intentions of other people, which is pretty important. You know, are you reaching for the cup, or are you reaching for a blunt instrument to bonk me with? Right? What are your intentions? That's very important to know, especially in early evolution primate groups. So those are the mirror neurons. The mirror neurons came out, and I think for me, with a lot of respect for the people involved in all that, I think it was just such a really cool thing that people got overenthusiastic. And when you have a great hammer, everything starts looking like a nail. Right? And so mirror neurons, basis of language, mirror neurons, basis of empathy, you know, mirror neurons, basis of whatever. Pizza making. Well, it's more complex than that. If you think about it, simulating the motor activities of other people is kind of important to do therapy with them or be married to them or teach them in school, but how important is it really compared to simulating, second, the emotions of other people, or third, theory of mind, where we simulate the mental activity of other people? I think the latter two are actually more fundamental to empathy, broadly defined, than, you know, simulating, you know, motor acts are. Okay? Okay. Great. But one good takeaway here that's practical is that if you want to promote empathy, a great way to develop empathic abilities is to activate the insula by tracking the internal state of the body. Any kind of mental activity that routinely tunes into the body could be yoga, it could be feeling your body while you tango, do the tango, whatever it is, certainly following the internal sensations of breathing, that will actually, as Sarah Lazar showed, make the insula thicker and stronger, which then increases empathic capacities to tune into the emotions of other people. And that's it. That's also a very good illustration of a recurring theme, if you will, a general principle. It's the idea of, how can I put it, wanting to strengthen some part of the brain. And so what we do, if we want to strengthen a part of the brain for mental activity A, but we happen to know that mental activity B also activates that part of the brain, and maybe mental activity B is a lot easier to get people to do, like it's easier to get people to tune into their breathing than to be emotionally empathic on command, right? That's kind of hard. If you've done couples counseling, kind of hard sometimes, all right? Anyway, that what you do is because now you have some understanding of what's going on inside the black box, you have people do mental activity B, like tracking the sensations of breathing, which builds neural function, which promotes mental activity A, emotional empathy, that you really care about. Okay. All right, I'll keep going. Now we're gonna have the bad news, the negativity bias of the brain. And I want to kind of highlight a phrase here, because neurons that fire together wire together. When you stimulate a neural region, you tend to strengthen it over time. So if you stimulate something, you strengthen it, for better or worse. Because deep down in the basement of the brain, it does not know or care what this firing is all about. And if it's firing, it's wiring. So, the negativity bias. If you think about it, in life, you know, our ancestors needed to really solve two fundamental, you know, problems. They needed to learn how to approach what was good for them and avoid what wasn't. In other words, they had to make a decision literally many times a day, whether it's a worm in a tunnel or, you know, an early mammal deciding whether to eat something or spit it out, or a primate ancestor deciding whether to approach an alpha female or male or steer clear, or an early human deciding whether to, you know, trust a stranger that they've never seen before, or you know, quickly bonk them on the head and take their land. Whatever it was, we had to decide, approach or avoid. Now, both are really important. Approach carrots, avoid sticks. The problem is that sticks are much more consequential for passing on gene copies. Alas, if you miss a carrot today, you probably have a chance at a carrot tomorrow. But if you fail to avoid a stick today, no more carrots forever. So we develop what's called a negativity bias. Some of the neural substrates of that are, one, the amygdala, which is sort of the alarm bell of the brain, right next to the hippocampus, technical side point. Because the brain is bilateral, it's divided in half, almost everything, there are two of them. The convention is to speak of them in the singular, which is confusing. So when I say the insula, they're really the insulae. There are two of them. It's not the amygdala, it's the amygdalae, whatever. But that said, I'll just talk about one of them. All right, the amygdala. It is the alarm bell. It basically is continually tracking the flow of information moving through the brain. Again, most of it below the field of consciousness. And then anything that it has previously learned as a threat or is on a short list of sort of genetically derived threats, like curvy snakes or sudden objects coming quickly, right? It will flag that and it will flinch away from it. So the amygdala is the alarm bell. About 70% of the neurons in the amygdala are there to track negative information. They're there to track sticks. So the amygdala is primed, if you will, to go negative. Another thing is that what happens is that we're continually scanning because of this low-grade trickle of anxiety. If you think about it, our ancestors, right? Our squirrel, monkey, early human ancestors that took MBSR were really laid back, you know? Just hanging out, being in the moment, following their breath, just absorbing contentment. This is really good, man. They got eaten, right? They didn't notice the slither nearby or the shadow overhead. Our ancestors that survived, and we're carrying their legacy inside us today, were nervous and cranky. So anyway, that's our brain. So this amygdala hippocampus system is driven by a kind of underlying, I'll get to that. Well, we'll talk about this slide definitely when I'm at the end. Scans for threats continually, right? When it doesn't see any threats, it really gets nervous, scans faster. Then as soon as it picks out one negative thing, the total surround is perfectly positive. You know, it picks that one thing out, really hyper-focuses on it, kind of ignores the rest. This has a lot of applications for therapy, doesn't it? People lose context really quickly when there's anything threatening out there in the world. And then that information is fast-tracked in the memory stores, has special circuits that just suck it into memory. It's flagged for easy, rapid retrieval down the road. And when it gets retrieved by any stimulus, any cue that is remotely associated to it, whoop, whoa, comes positively back up into the field of awareness. That's how the brain operates. So as a result, it's like Velcro, as I said earlier, for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. Think about it. The end of a long day, right? 100 things have happened. 80 were positive, mildly positive, most of them, but they were positive. You know, 19 were neutral. One was negative, right? What do we think about as we're falling asleep? That thing we should have said, the thing they said, you know, the email we suddenly realized we didn't, you know, get out. Whatever it was, that's the one thing we think about. That's what sticks. And it's unfair, if you think about it. It's deeply unfair. We go through life, most of the facts in our life are positive. Right? Most of the facts about our own nature are positive. But that positive information in terms of the default setting of the brain just sieves right through. It's like carrying water in a sieve. It just goes right through. But that one thing each day that's negative, so that happened to us or occurred in our world or we did it or we noticed about ourselves, boom, that sticks in the net. And then as soon as it sticks in the net, gets sucked into the brain forever after. That's how it works. It's tilted against quality of life. Consequently, negative trumps positive. Lots of studies there. You probably know Gottman's work with couples, where typically it takes about 5 positive interactions to neutralize 1 negative interaction. People in other studies, for example, will work much harder to avoid losing $100 than they'll work to gain $100. That's why the threat of loss is highly motivating, including in certain behavioral reinforcement programs. You know, rewards at risk are very, very motivating. One has to ask, whether it's skillful means or not to use those, but they are highly motivating. And I also think about the learned helplessness research, which you're probably familiar with. You know, dogs have a nervous system that's very much like our own in terms of emotion and motivation. It takes about 5 trials, ballpark, to train a dog in helplessness. It takes 50 to 100 or more trials to teach that dog it can do something to help itself out of a tough situation. Dogs trained in helplessness in different experimental paradigms, especially before the ethical standards for research on animals were tightened up, dogs trained in helplessness, you can just drag them in, you can bring them into a pen, put them on one side of a pen that has a line down the middle. The pen has got a metal floor. You can electrify one half of the pen, all right, and you can decide which half you electrify. You bring these dogs that have had 5 trials that have trained them in helplessness, set them in the side of the pen that can, and then turn on the juice. Zzz, not going to kill them, but it's very uncomfortable. They just lie there and whimper. They don't walk across the line to safety, most of them, right? And humans are very vulnerable as well. Mammals are very vulnerable to learning helplessness. It's interesting to wonder why that might have been adaptive in evolution, or was it just a fluke? Not everything that is genetically the way it is, it has evolutionary advantage. It's an error to over-infer evolutionary benefit from just about everything. But that said, it's worth asking, why would something that would seem so counterintuitive, if you're promoting survival, learning helplessness, be so deeply hardwired into the mammal, nervous system, yet there it is. And it has a lot of implications, obviously, doesn't it, for our clients, for whom a lot of the time we're working with them in terms of their helplessness. One of the takeaways for me has been around preventing learned helplessness by really focusing attention on little moments of efficacy. Little moments when we're a cue ball instead of an 8-ball, a hammer instead of a nail. All right, negativity bias, questions or comments? Yeah, please. You understand what again, please? Yeah, okay. Right, right. So, if I get you right, her question is getting at my comment earlier that our ancestors that lived were nervous and cranky. And there are many strategies. Probably one of the primary adaptive strategy, which has to do with the deepest and most ancient layers of the brain, is freezing. In other words, the freeze strategy evolved before the flight strategy, evolved. And so a lot of animals freeze when they're threatened. On the other hand, I think a lot of creatures, Mother Nature is, like we have hummingbirds that have to eat, I don't know what, how many times their body weight every day just to stay alive. At the other end, you have things like a sloth, or one of my favorite creatures I've ever seen, a slow loris. They conserve metabolic resources. That's about all I would know about that. So I think any of those strategies are viable. In our own evolutionary history, though, there's, alas, no question that there is a clear negativity bias in the brain. Couple others, and then we'll move on to what we can do about it. Now I'm nearing the end of the bad news. The rest of today is the good news. All right, please. Mm-hmm. Yes. So the question, if I got it, was a number of, when one is dealing with people who've had painful or even traumatic experiences, some treatment modalities revisit the trauma, often based on significant foundations that have been established first and, you know, with well-chosen clients. The question then is, when one revisits trauma, if neurons that fire together wire together, how do we not basically re-traumatize the person and deepen the memory trace, correct? So now, having restated your question, I'm going to defer answering it, if I could, to the afternoon, because in the afternoon I'm really going to go after trauma as a major topic. Is that okay? The fundamental answer is that there are skillful and unskillful ways to do that. That in terms of how, that are in terms of the looking at that through a neurological lens, there are skillful and unskillful ways to do that. And I'm going to talk about particularly, I think, skillful ones. Okay, maybe one more question? Okay, so you get it about the negativity bias, right? I mean, it doesn't mean that we're all necessarily going to be depressed, because most people actually worldwide report that they're kind of happy. That's sort of how they answer questions. I'm kind of happy. I'm kind of okay, you know? And that's probably because there are enough positive experiences that the sheer weight of them kind of tips the scales in terms of the negativity bias. But if you look at human history and you look at what people do when, you know, they're not settled into that home base of conscious, calm, contented, caring, and creative, right, the five C's, but they're threatened. At the crack of a twig, rustle of grass, you know, the cough of an alpha male or female in a primate troop, they're driven from home. We are driven from home, and then we're in the land of the negativity bias. So now, as we talk about this, and we focus increasingly on taking in the positive, taking in the good, it's important to acknowledge and bow to negative experiences. They have benefits, don't they? They, you know, anger orients us to injustice and mistreatment. Remorse helps us steer, you know, toward the light and away from the dark side of the force. Sadness, sorrow opens the heart. Anxiety alerts us to threats. I mean, there's a place for all of that. In psychological theories, there's the notion of optimal frustration in psychoanalysis, the idea that a little bit, it's a little bit like a vaccination, you know, where you give a little bit of a virus to somebody, a little bit of challenge can actually help people. Or notions, kind of more broadly, that negative experiences in terms of character building can increase the tolerance for stress, because you've been through it, you know you're going to be okay. It builds grit, resilience, and confidence. I got through. I think one of the most wonderful things when working with people who've been through tough situations is you're still here, you know? And those people often are not. You know, you made it. You made it. That right there is a beautiful takeaway, having come through really tough times. And then last, going through tough times ourselves really can increase compassion and tolerance for others. If you haven't had a tough, there are a lot of movies, there's a lot of literature about people who have been very privileged, who've chosen or been thrown into really tough circumstances and come through it with a lot more understanding for those people. Obviously, there's significant exceptions to that, but it is a potential benefit. On the other hand, negative experiences are stressful. And they activate the stress response system, the sympathetic nervous system, and the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, HPAA. The result is surges of stress hormones, like cortisol and norepinephrine. That produces fight, flight, or freezing behaviors. Also, in more complex ways, sometimes, you know, appease. People talk about freeze and appease, fight or flight behaviors. And most fundamentally, abandoning long-term needs for a short-term crisis. Wonderful book is Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers by Robert Sapolsky. I think it's on my list. It's a great discussion of the stress response system. I believe he's got a second edition out, which is updated. He's a wonderful writer and a wonderful guy. You know, we evolved to handle short bursts of stress, and during a short burst of stress, it makes sense. Forget building an immune system. Forget managing reproduction. Forget mood. Who cares about mood? Don't worry about long-term cardiovascular help. Get away from that, you know, lion, right, that's attacking the zebra. But most, in the wild, stressful experiences resolve very quickly, one way or another, right? And then, you know, that zebra either escaped or didn't, and the rest of the zebras are fine, because now, you know, we've moved on. But chronic stress chronically activates these systems with multiple pernicious consequences. The health consequences of chronic stress include, from a physical standpoint, weakening of five major systems of the body: immune, gastrointestinal, endocrine or hormonal, particularly with regard to reproductive hormones, cardiovascular, and the nervous system. And those disruptions in the body with long-term consequences also map to changes or disruptions in mental experience. For example, chronic stress lowers mood and increases pessimism and a sense of helplessness. It increases irritability and anxiety. As I said, increases learned helplessness, especially if there's no escape. It tends to reduce approach behaviors, a very interesting exception. A lot of research on stress in women, I'm blanking on her name, her first name is Shelley at UCLA, you probably know that research. Anyway, she found that, interestingly, most research on stress response has been on men, so she started researching women. As soon as you talk about gender, it's, as the Buddha called, a thicket of views. So I'm going to try to steer a little clear of that thicket of views, if you will, and there's always a difficult question, you know, what's nature and what's nurture when you think about gender differences and all the rest of that. That said, women tend to move more toward what Shelley Taylor called tend and befriend, as opposed to fight or flight in response to stress, often mediated by a particular hormone and neurotransmitter, oxytocin. Okay. Now, obviously, men can tend and befriend, just like women can fight or flee in response to stress, but tending and befriending is an approach behavior. Most people, when they're highly stressed, tend toward, you know, they're less interested in exploration and investing and taking chances and reaching out and making new friends, right? Because they want to secure a base of operations. First rule of warfare, Clausewitz, secure a base of operations, right? When we're stressed, we want to secure that base rather than go out and explore the world. And then last, stress activation primes aversion. For me, kind of pithy summary is that four words: sympathetic activation primes aversion. What I mean by that is that if you've got activation or arousal of stress, as we'll see I think in the next slide, you really light up the sympathetic nervous system and hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. That gets lit up. What that does is it's lit up, and it also, with feedback loops I'll get to in a moment, gets really sensitized by it. Let's remember that that system is primed to go negative. Remember, 70% of the neurons in the amygdala are there to track negative experiences or to track negative information. So if that system is primed to go negative, sympathetic arousal stimulates it and makes us increasingly inclined to go negative. That's why, for example, healthy excitement, like watching a performance of some kind and getting revved up, which involves lots of sympathetic activation in addition to positive emotion, can so quickly turn to anger. Have you ever noticed that when people are excited about something, it can very quickly become irritability? And that's because the sympathetic system primes, sympathetic arousal activates parts of the brain that are just ready to go negative. I think that's one reason why traditional contemplative practices, which are very alert to aversion, you know, disliking things, resisting the way it is, being upset. Fear and anger are primary modes of aversion. Okay, not liking it or being critical of it. Anyway, a lot of contemplative traditions, certainly the one I know best, Buddhism, which is very alert to dealing with aversion, is very big on promoting tranquility. Because tranquility cools the fires, turns down the dial on the stress response system in the brain. Okay. So, Neural consequences of negative experiences. This is a pretty important slide and a cool one. It's like what you have, although alas, I did revise it slightly. Interesting thing here is that the amygdala initiates a stress response. The hippocampus has three functions that are germane here. It forms and retrieves contextual memories. It puts the brakes on the amygdala. It inhibits the amygdala. And it inhibits the production of cortisol, a stress hormone. Cortisol, alas, stimulates and sensitizes the amygdala, the alarm bell, and over time, cortisol shrinks. It kills hippocampal neurons. Cortisol is like acid on the hippocampus. For example, it's been found that people who have fairly high levels of stress or anxiety or depression, or at the extreme have had extraordinary trauma, can have hippocampal shrinkage ranging from 6 to 25%. In other words, the hippocampus has shrunk by a quarter. Everybody naturally wonders, people wonder at this point, gee, can you grow hippocampal cells back? I've never seen a study that talks about that. I suspect it's hard to grow them back. You can't, once a neuron dies, it's gone forever, with the fundamental exception, though, of neurogenesis. So I'll talk about that briefly. Until probably 5 years ago, it was assumed that all the brain cells we were ever going to have, we had on the day that we were born. And after that, it was downhill. Well, interestingly, other creatures, like songbirds, for example, or other mammals, it's been discovered that in certain parts of the brain, including the hippocampus, new neurons are being born. Just in the last few years, serious scientific breakthrough, it's been discovered that the human hippocampus naturally produces new neurons on the order of maybe 1,000 or so a day. Estimates vary, but that's a ballpark number, kind of at the center of the estimates. 1,000 a day may seem like a lot. It's not very much in the brain as a whole. For example, the periods of time in utero where a fetus is building about 100,000 neurons a minute. Okay, there also are times, remember neural Darwinism, neuronal pruning, you know, a toddler has three times as many synapses as an adult. There are times in adolescence where adolescents are losing about 100,000 synapses a minute, which can account for some of the behavior in adolescence, I think. Anyway, long story short, the hippocampus does have neurogenesis, so that is hopeful in terms of growing cells back in the hippocampus. And one theory is that the reason that neurons are born in the hippocampus is that they aid the formation of new memories. And one of the interesting things is that depression seems to reduce neurogenesis in the hippocampus, which correlates with the ways that people sometimes think of depression as a learning disorder, that people are not learning from good experiences. They're having good experiences, but they're not learning from them. And another thing that promotes neurogenesis in the hippocampus is exercise. So after I leave here today, and starting tomorrow, I'm going to try to take my advice. Okay, so that's it about here. But you can see now we're set up a nasty one, a nasty vicious cycle. Because the bottom line, chronic negative experiences sensitize the amygdala alarm bell. They weaken the hippocampus so that there's less capacity to produce contextual memories. There's less ability to inhibit the amygdala alarm bell and less capacity to inhibit cortisol production because the natural condition is a kind of feedback loop, right? The result then becomes vicious cycles where this increasingly sensitized amygdala hippocampus system is really reacting to threat, which drives ever more cortisol production, which makes that amygdala hippocampus system even more reactive in the future. Not a good thing. Not a good thing at all. So, poignant truth. Mother Nature is tilted toward gene copies against personal quality of life. And as I said at the very beginning today, we've got caveman, cavewoman brains armed with nuclear weapons. What can we do? And now this is the corner where we turn and we focus on good news from here on out. But you can see the problem, can't you? It's a poignant one, isn't it? I mean, at the personal level, it's this feeling that you go through life and most of the things that happen and most of the qualities of you are good, but you end up feeling kind of eh on a good day. or worse. And then you look out at the world, and this planet is a jewel. I'm a real space nut, you know, if you know me. And it's really, really unusual, really, really unusual to have a planet like this. And we've inherited an amazing situation. I mean, even, for example, at the level that is quite astonishing when you reflect upon it, the early universe had no atoms, or very few, that were bigger than hydrogen and helium, at least in terms of ordinary matter. And all the atoms that are bigger, in other words, the oxygen we're breathing right now, the calcium in our bones or teeth, the iron in our blood, you know, the magnesium or whatever in the frames of your glasses, all that, the mercury and the fillings in your mouth, if you have amalgam, or not amalgam. Anyway, all of that was born inside a star. And mostly stars that blew up, because stars are giant fusion reactors that shove hydrogen together and make bigger atoms as a result. And when they blow up, kaboom, they make a bunch of heavy atoms, which then drift through space and form new stars, which cycle that again. And then around 9 billion years or so after the universe formed, there were enough of these heavy atoms floating around the universe through exploding stars that they could form rocky planets like this one right here, our planet right here. And then 4 or so billion years later, we're sitting in this room with stardust in our veins. We are stardust. So in that larger context, you know, this life could be, it's not a heaven realm, but it could be a very, very good realm. And in this context, we've got these caveman brains, cavewoman brains, that are very, very quick to read threat, and very, very quick, as soon as a distinction is made between us and them, to read them as threats or not human, not us, not people, and just pray to be exploited or abused or enslaved or mistreated or killed, right? That's the challenge, isn't it? And how do we go about dealing with that? So we go about dealing with it at the personal level in our own life as we practice as best we can over the course of our own lifespan. We try to help the people around us, and we help our clients, and we do what we can to make the world a better place. And one of the key ways to do that, I think, is to increasingly turn toward positive, what is positive, the positive experiences, not ignoring what's negative and problematic, but turn toward it and increasingly internalize it and build neural structure. And that's what I want to talk about now before we have lunch, okay? And we'll take lunch at 1, which is in about 15 minutes. Is that correct? Okay, great. So, as I say here, we can deliberately use the mind to change the brain for the better. So I'm going to move through a few familiar points quite quickly, and then let's do a practice just before lunch, okay? So, learning and memory. Basically, neural structure changes through learning. Learning is synonymous with changing neural structure, all right, for better or worse. And the result, broadly defined, is memory. Memory falls into two categories. These probably are familiar for most, if not all of us. Explicit and implicit. Explicit memory involves recollections for particular events, or semantic memory, like, you know, I'm in Sydney, right? Okay. Implicit involves 4 major things that are recurring themes and are targets of the positive internalization of experiences, namely bodily states, emotions, views, broadly defined, which are perspectives about the world, object relations, paradigms, expectations, representations of self and world, past and future, and our behavioral repertoire and inclinations. Implicit memory structures vastly exceed explicit memory structures. Explicit memory is important. Implicit memory is really, really important. So, if you want to increase neuroplasticity, because that's what we're talking here about, we want to increase neural structures and the capacity of structures to benefit from positive experiences. This, by the way, is a great slide. It's not in your set, sorry. I will email it to you. This is a pretty good list of mechanisms of action to pay attention to. Norepinephrine, moderate norepinephrine, promotes formation of synapses. Synaptic formation equals learning and memory. Dopamine does the same thing. As I said earlier, dopamine and norepinephrine can be associated with positive emotion. They promote synaptic formation and learning. Acetylcholine is a major neurotransmitter involved in the sympathetic nervous system, and or in the parasympathetic as well. It's very involved in the autonomic nervous system. Acetylcholine promotes synaptic formation. The brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF, does the same. There's a lot of research these days on how to give people BDNF in healthy ways to promote recovery from trauma. And last, maybe the natural opioids, the pleasure chemicals in the brain, like the endorphins, are maybe involved in promoting synaptic formation as well. So so basically, when one has a list like this of physiological factors that promote synaptic formation, reverse engineering time, the thing to do then is to think about, okay, how can I skillfully activate mental activity, mental states, that will promote those physiological factors, such as you see down below, these mental factors of intention, awareness, focused attention, attention that is sustained, multimodal, and intense. I'm going to come back to those three a lot because they're critical for taking in the good. Sustained, multimodal, felt throughout the whole body, maybe visualized as well, and sustained. So you get as many neurons as possible firing together as long as possible. And that's fundamentally how you defeat the negativity bias. Right? Mother Nature fast-tracks negative experiences, positive experiences, eh. So to defeat the eh, get those neurons, and a lot of those neurons, firing together a long time and intensely. And that's how we defeat the negativity bias. So there are key strategies in general for building new structure. The one I'm presenting today is not the only one. Sidebar, important point. I don't think I invented taking in the good. I think when you hear me talk about it, you'll realize that it's a mechanism of action that others have talked about or have left implicit or tacit in a lot of different therapies. What I'm trying to do today with you is to call out its critical elements and really think about them carefully in a neurodharma kind of way, both through the lens of brain science and also through the lens of contemplative practice. So these are key strategies. These are great. These are really, really great. Improve the way we think about things, cognitive therapy, perspective, look on the bright side. Just look for good news, pay attention to what's good, not pay attention so much to what's, negative, and to create positive experiences. These are all really, really good things. On the basis of these, there's an additional strategy, which is to take in the good. And these are the basically the three fundamental steps of taking in the good, which I'll practice with you momentarily, and then we'll review repeatedly. Basically, what a person does is turn positive facts into positive experiences. To do that, we have to register a positive fact. Second, sustain it. Let it be intense. Let it be multimodal. That's where those three things come up again. Sustained or intense, multimodal, and sustained. Right? And then third step, sense and intend that the positive experience is sinking into oneself. Sometimes people do that third step by visualizing it, like putting a jewel in the treasure chest of the heart. Later on today, I'll talk about how to do this stuff with kids. I love kids. I work with them a lot. And there are ways to adapt these methods for them. One is through visualization that's very concrete. Another is to sense that the experience is sinking in like a golden syrup or a light, if you will, kind of radiant and coming through you, and it's sinking in. I also sense that experiences are going into my back because threats and evolution came mostly at us from behind. And so the back tends to brace against the negative. So if we have a sense of taking good experiences into the back, we're particularly internalizing them then. I'm going to move through a couple more things, and then we'll do a practice, and then have lunch, okay? So, types of positive facts. So, we live in a world where a guy has to create a list like this, right? But here they are. These are positive facts. They include things that the bad thing didn't happen. I got in an elevator, and it did not crash to the earth, right? My head did not explode this morning. This tea is not poison. Or things that I was worried about didn't turn out badly. that letter, I get a letter in the mail from the tax authorities. Oh my God, you know, my heart speeds up, 20 beats. Then I open it up, it's just a form letter, throw it away. That's a good to take in. And then at the bottom of the list, we have much more profound stuff, including accessing the good facts, if you will, of the good qualities within each of us. Because of the negativity bias, most of us have a very, very unfair judge and critic inside our own head that renders judgments every day that are deeply, deeply biased, right? So to pay attention to the factual, objective reality of good qualities within ourselves, many of them quite modest and everyday and easy to overlook, patience, determination, good-heartedness, some generosity, compassion, a work ethic, trying hard over time. Those are still churning, right? Those are good things to notice in myself. So those are good facts. That leads to key positive experiences. And this is a great list to think about in terms of clients and the previous one. In other words, we have clients who characteristically, you could use this list diagnostically. In other words, some people are quite good at paying attention to certain kind of facts. On the other hand, they really suck at paying attention to other kinds of facts. Like, maybe they're good at noticing that the bad thing didn't happen, which is a weird way for them of reinforcing that they're surrounded by bad things. On the other hand, they're really terrible at realizing that there was something good that they did today. Another thing to think about diagnostically is where are people in terms of positive experiences. Like some people can access certain kinds of positive experiences, but others are really difficult. Like for example, I suspect that some of you, in ways that might have been surprising to you, could feel into a greater sense of safety. But when I said, okay, on demand, be happy. In other words, try to feel a greater sense of well-being or contentment or tranquility, nothing happened. You kept pushing the pedal, and there was no gas. You know, maybe that was an experience that was harder for you to access. I had a friend of mine say something kind of interesting to me and astonishing recently. She said, Rick, can you explain altruism to me? I don't get it. She just didn't get it. She didn't get altruism, for example. Okay. So you see this list so far? I think there's some critical ones here that I want to call out in particular. One is being connected. I'll talk later about the incredible importance of the third major motivational system in the brain, the affiliating system. We have basically three fundamental systems in the brain, an approaching system, an avoiding system, and an affiliating system. The third system, affiliating, mammals and birds have, primates really have, humans have to an extraordinary degree. It's very important for regulating the other two systems. I don't want to talk much about this today, but I'm developing kind of a theory about what is an awakened brain, what really is the nature of the brain in the very highest levels of human capacity and attainment. And it's a deeply balanced brain. It's the realized brain. And I think it has a fundamental balance and evenness and non-activation, in other words, non-clinging, related to approaching, avoiding, and affiliating, in part because of having those so profoundly fulfilled. Right? That's a mouthful right there. But with regard to the affiliating system, it's very useful, including obviously in therapy. Two other positive experiences I want to draw attention to. One is self-regulating. Self-regulating, which is so much of what we want to promote, right, in the people we help, is itself an experience. And that experience of successfully regulating oneself, in other words, of successfully not screaming at the kids or successfully not walking out of the therapist's office in a couples counseling session, even though your partner is just pissing you off, right? That's an experience of self-regulating. Or being able to turn attention away from the endless yammer of the internalized critic and finally say, thank you for sharing. Anything new? No? Shut up! That's good self-regulation. Taking that in, that's an experience that's available to be taken in. Okay? And then the last one I want to draw attention to is this whole sense of efficacy, which is the antidote to learned helplessness, feeling at cause, feeling capable. That is an important experience to take in, particularly related to little things. In other words, that I efficaciously managed to get the, you know, cup of coffee, right? Or larger things like I managed to accomplish the dishes today, or folding the laundry, or settling this sibling quarrel, or pushing send for the quarterly spreadsheet report. You know, I got that done. Those are opportunities for a positive experience of efficacy. Mm-hmm. Targets of taking in the good. This repeats what I said before. These four aspects of implicit memory are what we're aiming for. We are aiming to change bodily states, or we're aiming to internalize wholesome bodily states, wholesome views, wholesome emotions, wholesome behavioral repertoire and inclination. That's what we're aiming at through taking in the good. So just to quickly reprise a big intellectual chunk of material just before lunch on a very humid day. Oops, sorry about that. So we have positive facts, a range of important kinds or types of positive facts, types of positive experiences that are really important, all right, leading to targets inside the body mind of the person, including herself, that we're working with. Okay. And then last slide before lunch, why it's good to take in the good. And then we'll do it. So it writes an unfair imbalance. Mother Nature tilted four gene copies, tilted against quality of life. It gives oneself the caring and support that one may not have had. There are a lot of non-specific implicit benefits in taking the good. Implicit in it, embedded in it, is self-compassion and self-caring. Being on one's own side, having a kind of nurturing stance toward oneself. Deep down in the brain, it does not know if that experience of being cared about, attuned with, and given critical resources to, like love or validation or encouragement, it doesn't know whether those neural activations are coming from oneself or coming from grandma or a coach or a teacher or a guru or a parent's growing up or a loved one today. So by doing this to ourselves today, we implicitly are helping to remedy what may have been in short supply growing up. It increases positive emotions or positive resources, such as positive emotions and the capacity to manage stress and other experiences, and it can help heal trauma, and I'll get to that soon. This is why I think it's important to take in the good. It's interesting that in the spiritual traditions, for example, in Buddhism, there's this word called bhavana, which is cultivation. How do we cultivate the wholesome? That's where we started with today, wasn't it? How do we cultivate the wholesome, and how do we cultivate the abandonment or decrease or end of the unwholesome? And so that's the whole point. So let's do it. Let's do it as a practice. I'll guide you through this a couple times, and then how about we just go right into lunch afterward. I'll stick around for a few minutes, then I think I'm going to get whisked away, come back, and then we'll meet back, and I'll tell you when we'll come back. Okay? So, bring to mind a positive fact. Here's a helpful list. This gets at some skills that we will definitely address in the afternoon. Each of us has certain vulnerabilities, so for each of us, certain facts are particularly important to pay attention to. Speaking for myself, I grew up and I had quite a lot of personal autonomy. So the fact of autonomy and efficacy is not that important for me to notice. But for complex reasons, I grew up with, you know, not much validation. The narcissistic supplies were a thin suit and also a considerable amount of criticism. So for me, paying attention to the facts of accomplishment or you know, goodness inside or worth inside are important kinds of facts for me. See that as an example? And this varies for different people. So bring to mind, if you will, a positive fact maybe one that's targeted for you or just a good fact in general, and then let it become a positive experience. In other words, register it. Don't just know it conceptually. We're taking in good experiences, not good ideas. Because where we're wounded is in our feelings and in our body, primarily. So to heal, we need to take in positive bodily and emotional states or experiences. So step one, positive fact becoming a positive experience. Normally you'll do this quickly. I'll take you through this, you know, a little slowly so you can watch it. And then as you do this, second step, help that positive experience last. Be mindful of it. Savor it. It's delicious. Let it fill your body and be as intense as possible for the next 10, 20, 30 seconds. If it crumbles, as it naturally does, just regenerate it, go back to it. Maybe help yourself with that little half smile. Maybe move your body into a posture that's consistent with the particular positive experience you're having. And all the while, the third step, woven into the second, which you can do on your own, third step, sense and intend that this positive experience is sinking into you, soaking into you, like water into a sponge. Okay, you did it. You can open your eyes if they've been closed. Most of the time in life, we'll do this on the fly, just in the flow of life. Sometimes it's helpful to do it at specific times, like the end of the day, just before falling asleep. That's a great time to do this with kids, because they'll, you know, up to about age 12 or 13, because they'll put up with more psychobabble from parents to extend their bedtime. Right? So now let's do it one more time, because it's quick, and I'll move through it a little more quickly and leave you more to your own devices, because you're practicing a skill. Right? We're working with the mind here. So bring to mind a positive fact. Help yourself register it as a positive experience, step one. Step two, really savor it, relish it. Let it fill your body, let it be intense. 10, 20, 30 seconds. If it crumbles, just regenerate it. Third step, soaking it in, feeling it sift into you, becoming a part of you. Good. Okay, come back. That was the second one. Let's do one last time, all on your own, for 1 minute, and then I'll declare a lunch recess. Okay? So on your own, take yourself through the three steps. Find a positive fact, really savor it, soak it in. And I'll ring the bell in 1 minute. How about we talk about it after lunch? And don't run out yet. I think I need to make a couple announcements. So lunch will be an hour, that's right. Okay, so we'll resume at 2:10. In a few minutes it'll be 1:10. Apologize for going past 1. And we'll do more formal announcements before afternoon tea. And you want to make sure you get your certificate for coming. And do you want Tim to make some announcements?